A cross between ZZ Top and Sherlock Holmes. You're with Hesher on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Yeah, welcome back to the show, everybody. This is the Brian McClain Show on TNT. I'm going to be joined by Patrick Henningsen in this hour. You know him from TNT Radio. You know him from 21st Century Wire. And you know him from Alternate Current Radio. And you know him from UK Column. And you know him from lots of places. All right, so what is going on? Let's do a video clip. We'll do a video clip here. Here's some audio for you.
Nationwide, demonstrations breaking out after the so-called morality police there arrested a 22-year-old woman who later died in their custody. Her name, Mahsa Amini. Police say they arrested her because all of her hair was not covered. Iranian officials say she died of a heart attack, but her family says that is not true.
Eyewitnesses who were in the police van with her told us and our family that during the journey to the police station, she was tortured and insulted. Once they reached the holding room at the station, Mahsa, because of the torture, lost consciousness and collapsed.
Well, NBC News has not been able to corroborate that statement, and the family has not presented any evidence. Still, there were no family members present during her arrest. NBC's Ali Arouzi is in Tehran with what's happening on the ground.
The anger and the outrage in Iran is still palpable. As the protests continue to grow, so does the death toll. Officially, at least 41 people have been killed since the unrest began. However, Norway-based group Iran Human Rights say at least 76 people have died, but say the internet blackouts are making it difficult to confirm fatalities. Iranians have taken to the streets for an 11th consecutive night to protest against the death of Mahsa Amini in defiance of an unforgiving crackdown, severe warnings from the country's leadership, threats, and a near internet blackout. Iran's president issued a warning telling authorities that they must deal decisively with those who oppose the country's security and tranquility. Many arrests have been made. Security agents identifying people that attended protests at night, arresting them at home, at the office, or in student dorms. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, at least 20 journalists have been arrested, over half of them women, including Niloufar Hamedi, one of the first reporters to break the news about Mahsa Amini. The government has also shut down universities, as they are a traditional hotbed of dissent, while accusing the United States of trying to violate Iran's sovereignty over the protests, warning Washington of a response. But tonight, the protests seem to be a little smaller than previous evenings.
All right. We'll go from there. We'll call that one complete at that point. For a complete list of shows and our schedule offered on TNT Radio, simply visit our website at tntradio.live. We serve up the latest live news and current affairs presented by a host of credible and expert commentators who can separate fact from fiction and truth from propaganda right here on TNT Radio.
The news you want.
They cover the important story.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
He's a host here on today's News Talk. He's the founder of 21st Century Wire. He's a founding member at Alternate Current Radio. He's the host of the Sunday Wire podcast. And he's got a lot of on-the-ground experience reporting, living, working in the U.S., in Europe, and in the Middle East. He's joining us now on the Brian McClain Show. Patrick Henningsen, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining.
Hey, how you doing, Hesher?
I'm good. I appreciate you coming on. I know you're really busy, and you'll be doing your show on TNT tomorrow morning, at least very early morning for you, pretty early morning for me. I think you start at 7 a.m. Central Time, but enjoyed your conversation with Blake Lovewell earlier this week on your Tuesday show. Recommend people go check that out if they missed it. He's got a great set of stories, a two-part story he's working on there. But yeah, I wanted to talk to you about this whole Mahsa Amini story out of Iran, because you've actually been to Iran before and know a little bit more about how things work there. And I know you know a lot about how the media treats it. And I was saying earlier in the show, Iran is kind of weird because both sides of our media like to demonize Iran. You know, the Fox News side likes to say they are the sponsors of state terror and stuff like that. And then, as you heard from the CNBC side in that opening clip there, well, they like to focus on human rights and stuff like that when it's convenient for them. So what do you think about this? And I also noticed in the clip they said that NBC was not even able to confirm some of the claims that are made there. So how does this work? What are we what can American listeners learn from this particular story?
Thanks, Brian. I think it, you know, I've visited Iran briefly. I'm familiar with the country, the people, and the government system there, and also the religious culture there. It's very strict on certain things, not unlike the Gulf states, and not unlike other conservative Islamic countries around the world. But it seems to gather the lion's share of criticism and activism and color revolutions from the West. So it's no secret that there's been a desire by the U.S. and its allies, mainly the U.K. and the U.S. I think they're running tandem on this project, as they did with Operation Ajax in 1953 with the overthrow of democratically elected Mohammad Mossadegh. That was a coup, U.S.-led, but it was a British-U.S. Joint operation. I think what you're looking at here is an attempt at a color revolution, and I think it's again U.S. and British operation. It just has all the hallmarks of it, the way that the media script has been designed. And you're right to point out that the Western media, even they can't confirm the allegations. They ran with the talking point right out of the gates that Mahsa Amini was killed in custody by the religious police. That's basically the headlines that drove the story. Then they pull back slightly after the emotion is unleashed around the world, and they pull back a little bit. And then you have Shepard Smith, who is just a reprehensible character, like literally, I think he was booted out of Fox News and found a home at NBC. I mean, a terrible propagandist. And even he has to admit that the statements has not been corroborated. You know, they don't have any actual evidence. It's all alleged. But it's too late for that because the genie's out of the bottle. And that's exactly what the U.S. and the British wanted for this. It does look like similar to previous color revolutions, but this is actually has a lot in common with George Floyd, and not in the racial sense or anything like that. In that, if you look at the George Floyd case very closely, and if you sat through the trial of Derek Chauvin, which we did, watching it remotely, and you listen to all the arguments and look at all the evidence that was presented by the defense, by the prosecution, it becomes very clear that the circumstances surrounding George Floyd's death had quite a lot of other things feeding into it. But the narrative had already been unleashed. As soon as that cell phone video was released, that clip made it to the national news cycle, then the rioting began. Then it became a Black Lives Matter activist concern, kind of a U.S. domestic color revolution of sorts. And that's what happened here. I think it seems more likely, at least the Iranian authorities released CCTV camera footage. And it does look that Mahsa Amini fell or had a bad fall of some sort in the police station, where she injured herself. Now, I don't know exactly what happened before or after that, but there's suffice to say that all the facts are not in, and we don't know the whole story. We don't know, like George Floyd, we don't know her health condition. As you know, George Floyd had multiple debilitating health conditions at the time of his arrest, including a horrific heart condition, blocked arteries, and he was also had ingested a significant doses of fentanyl and methamphetamines, which is lethal. So nonetheless, the stress probably had a lot to do with in his underlying conditions. We don't know the story of Mahsa Amini, but what we do see is a concerted effort by the Western media, Western governments from 2009 with the Green Revolution, so-called Twitter revolution in Iran. And this looks like a sort of a redux of that. This looks like a kind of a new replay, a new updated version of that. And what they're trying to do is sow distrust against the government in Iran, which we call in the West the regime. But in terms of the hijab issue, the women's issues, and making it a feminist war, that worked pretty well for Afghanistan. That got the liberal left behind there, saying NATO's in there to liberate the women from the Taliban and the brutal medieval treatment of women, etc. That did help to galvanize support amongst the Western liberal classes. And so here they would also support this rebellion or regime change, or if there's violence in the street, they would be cheering it on, much like they were cheering on the violence in America with the George Floyd riots across the country. So there's a lot of similarities here, more similarities than one would initially think with what happens in countries like America, more so, I think, than it has happened in other color revolutions, which have been along sectarian lines, mainly Sunni versus Shiite in Syria, and Al-Qaeda, sort of radical factions versus the state. So it's a different dynamic. But here you can kind of see this is very, it's got the Western fingerprints on it. And of course you can see that right through the media coverage as well. But that's my initial thoughts.
Yeah, I've kind of noticed that too, and it made me wonder, is a color revolution possible in Iran? Like, is Iran as susceptible to that as, say, I don't know, Libya or Syria or some of the other ones that we've seen? I mean, gosh, there's such a long list of them, but I always kind of felt like that would be more difficult to accomplish in Iran, but I'm not really sure how to justify that assumption that I have. Am I on to something there, or is this very possible that these techniques and tactics could actually work in Iran?
There are structural issues in Iran that make it unlike Libya or Syria. You know, Iran, in terms of just take Tehran, the capital, that's a megatropolis of 10 million, you know, 10 to 15 million in terms of greater Tehran, and in terms of the population of the country, it's not a minuscule country. It's got big cities. It's got a well-developed internal police force. It's got a well-developed sort of national investigative body, law enforcement, military, Revolutionary Guard. And I think while there might be a large pro-Western contingent that, you know, would want to see, they make it all about the hijab. Of course, that's just one issue that, and it's not a central issue. Probably it's more like an ornament. But there actually wouldn't be, I think, a majority support for that issue to be leading a revolution in the country. So it's a non-starter. It'll get some headlines. They'll get certain types of people out, few thousands of students and so forth. They'll get international attention, but it's not going to move the dial in the country. What will more likely move the dial is some type of an economic collapse, because the majority of the people in there support the state, and they do realize that they're under embargo and that their economic woes are largely because of U.S.-led sanctions. So they're very aware of that. They're well-educated on that front. So they know that if they have to choose, either be subservient to Washington politically or suffer through sanctions, they're going to choose sanctions, because they know that the alternative, it won't go anywhere in that country. So, but the color revolution regime change, kind of the targeting by the Western liberal or neoliberal types, is the Democrat-led Obamaites, Clinton, Biden administration, and the neocons. So there's an alliance in the West, in the U.S., that want to see this country destabilized. But they're kind of living, they're still living in 2010, you know, believing that Twitter, kicked off the Arab Spring. And so Libya, a lot of the areas were indefensible. The government was not in, didn't have strong defensible positions because they never could contemplate that there would be thousands of jihadis imported in to topple the government, and that NATO would be so brazen to have a no-fly zone. They were caught by surprise. Same with Syria to some degree, although Syria was as much better sort of state structures in place, plus support from its allies in Russia and Iran. Iran doesn't need that support. They have plenty of manpower and human resources in the country, very strong political belief systems, very strong religious belief systems. So like it or not, it's not the freest country in the world in terms of, you know, being allowed to, for if you're a woman, to, you know, go dress as you like in any part. Very conservative on that front. Security is very high. They're very strict in that country with certain things because they have been infiltrated and people have been assassinated by Israeli intelligence, and their top scientists are dead. Their heads of the nuclear energy program dead, you know, so they're at war. And so this is what the Westerners pretend they're not at war. And they think, oh, what's wrong with those Iranians? Why do they say death to America at the mosque? Like literally up on the video screen on a ticker tape playing at the mosque when you walk by, death to America, down with the American regime. And I know what they mean is they mean the government, the, you know, this kind of imperialist, aggressive, destroy Iran at all costs. That's what they mean. They don't mean all the people in America, but it's interpreted as such. But it's not for nothing. You know, there's a reason for it. And they're very aware that they've basically been meddled with and pushed around. And, you know, if we hadn't overthrown their democratic government in 1953, it'd be a very different country right now. Be a progressive, more westernized country, more like, probably very different, you know. But we did what we did, and that caused a series of events to unfold over the decades and led to the Ayatollah Khomeini coming into power, and then they lopped sanctions on, and Israel started doing their attacks and sending malware, Stuxnet attacks against their civilian nuclear power. I mean, it's serious business. So they're not messing around. We're messing around with them, but they're not messing around at all. They know exactly what the score is, but we don't. Our people and our governments, I don't think they fully comprehend what's going on and what the effects and ramifications would be for the types of things that we do to try to intervene and dislodge governments, especially like the Iranian government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes good sense. Let me take a station break here, and we'll come back and we'll pick up where we left off. I'm joined by Patrick Henningsen, everyone. You're listening to Today's News Talk.
Christina Borgeson on TNT Radio.
3 months after being appointed CIA director in 2017, Mike Pompeo gave a speech in which he said, quote, "It's time to call out WikiLeaks for what it really is, a non-state hostile intelligence service often abetted by state actors in Russia." In January of this year, our intelligence community determined that Russian military intelligence, the GRU, had used WikiLeaks to release data of U.S. victims that the GRU had obtained through cyber operations against the Democratic National Committee. That's all Mike Pompeo talking here. Actually, even today, no proof of this particular allegation by Mr. Pompeo has ever seen the light of day. His characterization of WikiLeaks, which has always been a media organization whose work product was widely picked up and published in other major media outlets, is also inaccurate. Nonetheless, Pompeo and the U.S. intelligence community, aided and abetted by operatives in other nations, has led a ruthless, relentless international intelligence community operation to all but kill WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Julian Assange.
Christina Borgeson on Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Google and Facebook, they don't sell you anything. They sell you.
Facebook constantly manipulates their users. They do it by the things that they insert into the news feeds, and they do it by the types of hosts they allow their users to see.
It's what Google and Facebook are doing on a regular basis, by suppressing stories, by steering us towards other stories rather than the stories we're actually seeking. That's the real manipulation that's going on.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts.
It will always favor
one online music service over another and one candidate over another,
Google and Facebook,
has the power to undermine democracy without us knowing that democracy has been undermined.
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Discover how society is manipulated by Google and Facebook. The creepy line at salemnow.com.
Elon Musk wants Jack Dorsey to turn over Twitter info on spam or spam bot accounts. Yet the Australian government and Digi, which includes Twitter, wants to address fake bots and fake accounts. The disinformation and misinformation is from the government and big tech. Disagree with what government is saying and you'll be shut down and could face severe penalties. To find out more, go to digi.org.au. Lighting the fuse for freedom. This is TNT Radio.
That's right. We're back lighting that fuse. Listener Al My Neck writes in my chat, Patrick, Iran riots brought to you by the National Endowment for Democracy, the Soros Open Society, and a host of Western NGOs. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. I mean, that's what those organizations specialize in. The main part of their, you know, it's to they coordinate media coverage. They all of those have their own websites as well, and then the mainstream media will riff off of articles or statements by experts from the Open Society Foundation or the National Endowment for Democracy, or they kind of act as a PR agency to get their talking points and their issues into the mainstream media. And also they feed those into the political leadership as well in the United States. So everyone's kind of on the same page. As it were. But I mean, they're just kind of open about it. They're not holding back at all in terms of what they really think about it. What's interesting as well is this was brought up by Brian Berletic, who's very good analyst, a New Atlas. He's been a guest on my show a few times, and he's always pointing people to the Brookings Institute document, which was published in 2009, called Which Path to Persia. And, you know, when you read some of the parts of this document, it's just unbelievable. You know, this is the de facto U.S. policy. For instance, it'll say here, Masha Amini is actually Kurdish, because there's a Kurdish ethnic enclave in Iran, as there is in Iraq, in Turkey, in Syria. And in each of those countries, the Kurds are used to spearhead separatist breakaway movements. And that destabilizes the government. Certainly Erdogan in Turkey's had his hands full with that. You know, so even though they're a NATO country, they're likely having to deal with US intelligence subterfuge at the same time. That's more to kind of keep them in check. They use the Kurds in Iraq literally to try to form a breakaway state to take a third of Iraq away and call it Kurdistan. And in Syria, they're doing it right now. The U.S. is occupying northeastern Syria, and they're using the ethnic Kurdish population there to try to tear the most lucrative and wealthy part of Syria in terms of oil and resources, tear that away from Syria. And here in Iran, the same thing. So she's Kurdish. So is that a coincidence? Well, if you look at the Brookings document, it'll say, quote, for instance, the United States would opt to work primarily with various unhappy Iranian ethnic groups, i.e. the Kurds, the Baluchis, the Arabs, and so on, who have fought the regime at various periods since the revolution. A coalition of ethnic opposition movements, particularly if combined with dissident Persians, would pose a serious threat to the regime's stability. Well, there you go. In addition, the unrest the groups themselves create could weaken the regime at home. At the least, the regime would have to divert resources to putting down the rebellions across the country, i.e. multiple protests in multiple regions in Iran. At the most, unrest might discredit the regime over time, weakening its position vis-a-vis its political rivals. So that's just like a little taste of all the sort of nuggets in that document. And I mean, I think the Biden administration, I think it's the New York Times, they've got an article that was they just published actually on this, and they're sort of boasting. They're boasting about what their sort of plan is, and they're pretty much spelling it out now. Look, now this is the New York Times. Now the race is on to get the communications equipment into the hands of the protesters. No small task in a country where the government is determined to shut down any view outside from the outside world, which may bring into depth, show the depth of its crackdown after the death of police custody of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini, who was accused of violating the law in headscarves. So there you go. New York Times headline, Biden's support for Iran protesters comes after bitter lessons of 2009, i.e. we did not act soon enough. We did not give enough to the opposition to overthrow the government back then. Let's not make the same mistake twice. Yada, yada, yada. You know the drill. So there it is.
Yeah. Yeah, we've seen this before. We've seen this this pattern before. Definitely got employed in Syria. It's been employed all over the place. It's older than dirt at this point. Okay, let's. We're gonna take a headline break here, and when we come back, I'm gonna ask you about some of the cultural aspects, some of the on the ground human rights stuff, and talk about the stamp down of this protest. But we'll do that after some headlines here with today's news talk.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. Hurricane Ian rapidly intensified off Florida's southwest coast Wednesday morning, gaining top winds of 155 miles per hour, just shy of the most dangerous Category 5 status. North Korea has test-fired two more missiles the day before Vice President Harris goes to South Korea. Russia is preparing to annex four more areas of Ukraine its troops took control of during the invasion, following a referendum vote that the U.S. claims is a sham.
The common housefly. Caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa. Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
That's funny because I actually have a fly in my studio right now. Alex is watching me dance around here on my camera trying to avoid this thing. It just landed on my nose. Great timing with the ad break there. Welcome back, Pat. How you doing? Thank you for everything that you do, and thanks for helping us try to understand this issue going on in Iran right now. I'm curious if you could maybe talk to me a little bit about some of the cultural aspects as it as they relate to, you know, just what it's like to maybe be a woman or a gay or a dissident in a country like Iran, and like how brutal are these protest stamp downs compared to ones that like we have here in the United States or Canada, for example, with the trucker protests, or maybe you know, you got the Danish farmer protests, we got farmers getting pulled out of tractors at gunpoint. Like how is it really that much more different there, the protest stamp downs, and with regards to the human rights, like are people happy there? Do all women hate wearing hijabs? I mean, anything you can tell us about the actual cultural situation on the ground and how that may or may not jive with the narrative that we're getting.
Well, one thing's for sure, the government there is not going to basically take CCTV images and try to identify all the protesters and then freeze their bank accounts so they can't eat like they did in Canada, a free country, a free liberal democracy, Canada. Probably not much different, no more or less violent than sort of the U.S. jackboot kind of riot police that you see during the G7 or G20 protests or different things like this. Certainly no different. The UK maybe a little bit softer than the UK in some levels. I don't think they went hell for leather on COVID in the way that we did in Europe, although they had their share of a scare there where everyone was paranoid, not unlike Europeans. They have a lot in common with Europeans culturally. Take away the religious veneer. It's a very sophisticated metropolitan culture there, especially in Tehran, but also very conservative. So if you've been to Saudi Arabia, or not as conservative as Saudi Arabia, and not parts of, you know, outside of Dubai, Abu Dhabi is very conservative, as is parts of you know, countries like Qatar and some places. So maybe less so, but aside from the headscarf issue, but you know, that's full cover in Saudi Arabia in most places. You know, you get chased out, arrested, or who knows, or worse. I wouldn't know what it's like to be all those things you mentioned, because I'm not, and I haven't been there in that capacity, so I wouldn't know. But it's a very conservative country, maybe very concerned. You could even say in some cases paranoid, because they've been basically at war, on war footing, for so long. So we can go in and assassinate a bunch of people, or Israel can do that. We can bomb their nuclear power facilities, or, you know, and that's not an act of war for the U.S. It doesn't consider what it does as an act of war. It's just some sort of preventative tactical measure, surgical measure, whatever. For Israel, it's their self-defense. So, but for Iran, we have to realize that that's an act of war. When you assassinate their top military commander, who was going to be the future supreme leader of the country, Qasem Soleimani, the people are going to take that. They're not going to take that well, and they're going to realize that, the West want all of their top people dead, and they don't want to negotiate. They don't want to have any kind of rapprochement. They just want to crush the economy and knock off their leadership, like kill them. So, I mean, that's the way the Iranians look at it. And if you're in that position, you probably would look at it that way too. But we have this weird kind of chauvinistic, bizarre view of the world in the U.S., and in the UK as well, where a lot of people don't think, or Canada, they think that somehow these are anti-terror operations and this is just routine, and these are savages running around the Middle East, and they're Muslims, and need to be put down and taught to heal, and all this sort of stuff. There's a deep meta-psychological gulf between these parts of the world, unfortunately, and that's why you see this disparity in thinking in terms of diplomacy. And if you listen to the Iranian foreign minister, he's totally articulate, one of the sharpest geopolitical minds in the world, foreign spokesperson Javid. He's brilliant, much smarter and much more dexterous and more eloquent than any U.S. envoy, probably in the last 20 years. So, but he's completely disregarded and ignored by the Western media, as is Sergey Lavrov, another highly skilled, erudite, well-educated, articulate diplomat, who's basically regarded as, Martin Bormann by the Western media. You know, it's just, so it's really hard. So we're never going to understand. Especially the U.S., we don't want to understand what life is like in Iran. We don't care. So it's like, and they know that they're coming to realize that, many Iranians, hence everything we do is having a less and less effect. We're not getting the numbers and the support we did with all of these sort of regime change, color revolution gimmicks in the past. And everyone's scratching their head saying, whoa, why aren't they going for it anymore? Where's the Twitter mobs? You know, they thought that Twitter could send the Arab Spring shooting off around in liberation movements all over the place. Doesn't work anymore. And the Zuckerbergs and Dorseys of the world and all Google, and they're scratching their heads like, what do we do? Well, then they go to the U.S. government. What do we do? And well, I don't know. Well, maybe we start blowing things up, you know, pipelines, whatever.
Right. Yeah, send in the Open Society, send in the National Endowment for Democracy. You can start like kicking things off. So it seems to me that the and of course, you know, I'm not there. I can't say for sure, but from what I can tell, it seems like the treatment of women is pretty similar in places like Saudi Arabia, Dubai, Qatar, if people prefer.
It's not even close.
Really?
And when you go to the only thing that the West can point to there is the dress issue. If you go to Iran, you quickly realize the country is run by women. There is no doubt about it. Look at the middle and upper management of most organizations features women, and right to the top. So you may have the figureheads as male. It may look like a patriarchy. The women run Iran. They're the most educated. They're the most highly skilled. They're leading in science. They're also in engineering. They're in politics. The women run the country. So in some ways more dominant than the men on many levels. So, and that's not the case in Saudi Arabia, not even close, or any of the Emirates. Maybe the closest I would say is similar to Syria, where there's, very good representation in terms of leadership and with women and men. Of course, it's never going to be equal for various reasons, because also women are actually having families and getting married and doing traditional things in Syria and Iran as well. So they don't have the same demographic problems that we have in Western Europe and the United States, but not similar at all. In fact, that's one of the most surprising things that really surprised me when I was there.
Wow. Yeah, I formed the question that way because I didn't want to overstate it or assume anything. But from what you just said, I guess the question is answered. So from your assessment, the treatment of women, their opportunities for women, is actually better in Iran than it is in our own country's allied countries in the Middle East. Isn't that intriguing?
I would say so. Yeah, I would say so. And you can go deeper on the cultural level. Is that there's not women there? We might say, oh, they're slaves to the men. They have to wear a headscarf. The headscarf they wear in Iran is like halfway down their head. And it depends what community you're in, or what city or town or village, as to how far that scarf is going to cover your hair. If you're in Tehran, it's literally off the back half of their head. So you can see half their hair. And they're very careful how they position it. It's fashion. It's not unlike you go to a Midwest or Wyoming or Montana, and women will dress very different downtown on a Saturday night than they would in, Los Angeles. It's just the way it is. That's conservative tradition versus urban liberal. And they have the same dynamics there. And it says, and the same with university educated, comes from a respectable family, wants to project that image to a prospective mate, i.e. I'm looking for a husband. Husband's looking for a wife. He's looking for a certain type of wife from a certain type of family that looks a certain way, that sends a certain message, like she's respectable and her family's respectable. That's important to them in their country. Even we might have lost that in the West, but it wasn't a couple generations ago. Our grandmothers or their grandmothers or mothers, your great grandmother further back, many of them in some communities in the United States would have their heads cut with a headscarf. And so what's the difference there? The difference is what? 80 years? 90 years? So I will contend that keeping the maximum pressure on a country like Iran is going to keep those sort of issues hardened. The country would probably loosen up if they loosened up the economic pressure and political pressure. But because it is the way it is, then that keeps the kind of hardliners in power. That's the irony of this situation.
That is ironic. So basically we're hurting their progression by all of the actions that we've taken since 1953 and leading up to 1953. We've actually intentionally stymied progressive tendencies from a very well-developed country. Pretty interesting there.
Yeah, you could say that. They don't have the problem of over-sexualizing their youth in schools, which is a big problem in the United States. This is a big issue now. Glenn Youngkin, basically won the governorship on that issue, pretty much, or related issues. And the school board parents are up in arms across America. They're bringing in drag queens to hypersexualize the children at a young age, injecting gender fluidity and all the these sort of things at younger and younger ages. Very disturbing reports we're seeing by the day right across America. You don't have those reports, so they don't have that problem there. Okay, so they might have other problems, but they don't have that problem. So no country, I will say what I've learned over the years, having traveled a little bit, is that no country is perfect, and it's a question of trade-offs. There is no such thing as utopia. There's just trade-offs. The highest so-called happiness quotient in the West is supposedly Finland, I think, in terms of that polling that they do every year. But Finland also has the highest suicide rate. So there's trade-offs. You know, this,
right.
You'll see this story played out in every country. Everyone has pluses and minuses. Everyone's looking for that happy balance in the middle. And that's where, you know, a lot of people will say is the best quality of life. And there's very, very hard to find. Admittedly, a lot of people spend half their adult life looking for that if they're really wealthy and they can move around. Not easy to find. So Iran's got its share of problems and external pressures as well that makes it even more complicated and more pressurized in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. People are fed up with government everywhere, all over the world. And, you know, that whole thing makes the Western exceptionalism line seem to be sort of a stupid virtue signal, that's sort of low hanging fruit at this point, because nobody's happy with the government here either. And how convenient for them to say, oh, look what's going on over there. We can't really verify it, but check this out. Look what's going on in Iran. Isn't it awful? All right, I got to take one more station break here. We'll be right back, everybody, with Patrick Henningsen on TNT.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
Here's something I wrote back on June 1st. Sky-high gas prices, supply chain problems, the threat of people not being able to get out of a hurricane area due to the nature of the season, rapid inclose development within a couple of days of the coast are just a few of the many considerations, only one of them, the last one, having to do with the weather. The others have to do with the energy policy worthy of Chavez's best days. Hurricane forecasting has always been a high-pressure job, ironically, given they are low-pressured. But for the Biden administration energy policy, we have really upped the ante as far as these things. This is a disaster in the making, more so than what it would have been anyway, because the recovery is going to be slow. Hits near Fort Myers, comes back out over the water near Daytona Beach, with a second hit likely on the Georgia-South Carolina coast sometime late Friday or Saturday. And the things I listed for you there, written on June 1st, I fear are going to come true. This is WeatherBell.com meteorologist Joe Bastardi for TNT Radio, reminding you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
Emergency, police, fire, ambulance.
Yeah, g'day, mate. Need an electrician.
Do you need police, fire, or ambulance?
No, I just need an electrician. I've got a couple old crappy power points I need to get changed
Look,
over.
Look, I'm sorry, I can only connect to the police, fire, or ambulance.
Well, I need to talk to an electrician.
This is for emergencies only.
This is an emergency. I'm moving into the house and I need to get an electrician to change these power points.
000's sole job is to connect you to your nearest emergency service. So please, stay relevant and save 000 for urgent assistance only.
When the whole world seems turned upside down, we sort through it together.
Lighting the fuse for freedom.
TNT Radio.
All right, final segment. I'm joined by Patrick Henningsen. We're talking about what's gone on in Iran. The Mahsa Amini story. She's been arrested, allegedly, for too much hair showing. And officials say she died of a heart attack. The family claims she was tortured and insulted and died in custody after losing consciousness. But the mainstream media here in the United States cannot confirm this, but we're running with it apparently as though it is fact. I've seen this on social media, people all over the place talking about this and trying to show their solidarity with human rights. But we just honestly don't really know all of the facts. And unfortunately, our media will only drop that as a little bit of a side note while they go over the narrative with you. Patrick, I noticed that Elon Musk was looking at the internet situation there. What is up with Musk? You know, he did the same thing with Ukraine. He sent over all this Starlink gear, and now he's talking about how he needs to send Starlink gear over to Iran. What's the deal? Did they shut the internet down? Is Elon Musk going to be the hero for the Iranian people, or is this all just bluster?
No, that's exactly what I just shared with you from the New York Times, where I said that our concern now, they said, is to get the communications equipment into the hands of protesters across the country so they can have multiple uprisings in multiple cities. So that's like literally right out front on the New York Times. They're not even hiding it. So that's Musk is, so he did something similar in Mariupol where he gave Nazi militants Starlink gear. It was couriered, and some, a lot of people died to get that to them, by the way, and they ended up losing and ended up getting, having to surrender anyway. So it was all for naught. But so he decided to back Nazis, which I think is interesting. And I'm surprised the left didn't criticize him for that, being South African. They'd like, yeah, many of them taken a swipe at him for being from apartheid South Africa, even though he's, I think he's actually Canadian. Well, he's more Canadian in terms of where he's spent his youth, maybe. I'm not sure. But no, you know, I think he was older. He came to Canada. But someone like Musk, anybody who's in a CEO position of any tech company who's doing any international business will invariably be approached by the U.S. government. And it's kind of there's a sort of arrangement whereby they will be asked by the U.S. government, CIA or FBI, I don't know which department handles it, but probably national security, probably NSA or something. But they'll say, well, we're going to give you security briefings. We're going to give you national security briefings, classified briefings. So people who are in high level positions, especially in tech and science, will be offered certain briefings. They don't even, not even people that work in government agencies, but they're sort of leaders. They'll be given briefings, and in return, and that gives them a somewhat of a competitive edge in their respective fields. You can imagine, be the same for journalists who get these briefings, right? They have sources in government, high level sources, gives them the edge, right? But the quid pro quo is, if they come across any information that might be of national security interest, they are obliged to report that to said agencies. You see how that works. So that's an unofficial arrangement that has been observed with certain people. I don't know if Musk has that arrangement, but he is definitely coordinating probably with the CIA, with the NSA and the Pentagon on this. And so, hey, you know, he has to play for the A team. Otherwise, you're not allowed to play. It's probably something along those lines. But to think that a little bit of tech is going to make the difference in that situation, I think is, that might have been the case back in 2009, 10, 11, maybe 12. But I don't think that's as much the case now. So those miracles of social media and stuff, it's not, I don't think it's as easy now as it was back then. The novelty's worn off for one. And the other thing is it's not going to radically alter facts on the ground, but it can create enough international media coverage. But the liberal classes in the West are deluded because they think that, you know, mainstream media is reality. They've come to believe that and feel that, and it's their last sort of vestige of hope, and so they'll keep playing that card even though it's giving diminishing returns. You see that domestically in the United States, certainly the case. You know, they have the levers of censorship. That's one thing, but promoting political movements and regime change strictly in a digital virtual sense, in a mainstream media sense, has limited payback, I think, in some of these situations, more and more so, not least of all because people are just kind of aware to the game now. But
I'm glad to hear that. I'm noticing that too. The tactics, techniques, and procedures of you know, the government, the mass media, the National Endowment for Democracy, Open Society, et cetera, it's all become very easily accessible information now, regardless of, you know, what your country or creed is. So people are figuring this out from all areas of the spectrum, you know. So that's definitely good to see. Going back to the hijab itself, it's my impression that many Islamic women do not actually feel oppressed by the hijab. Is that accurate? I mean, and the pictures of the young woman in question, very compelling. The pictures of Mahsa Amini that they have up are, you know, she's a beautiful young woman. She's clearly, in the picture I've seen, you know, she's, like you said, she looks like she lives in the urban area or was photographed in it and had, you know, her head covering, just basically covering half of her head. I could see plenty of her hair. Looked like she, you know, rolled that way pretty much regularly. You know, she looked very comfortable in it. And I don't know, the images, just the compelling nature of the images, I think are an interesting factor here with regard to this woman.
Yeah, there's a double standard as well. And France has passed this whole series of laws banning the hijab. So they're so paranoid about the image of the Islamic extremist in France that they're discriminating against women who want to wear a headscarf for religious reasons. They're discriminated against. So zero liberty for them, for their religious beliefs, not allowed to wear it because it scares the French, allegedly. I don't think it does, but it probably has become an issue. So that's a major European leading NATO EU country. And in the United States, what happened in the last 2 years, the government mandated that you have to wear masks in many places, local, state, and federal government in different situations, schools, mandatory masks. So mandatory dress code that was detrimental to your physical health, but you had to do it. Otherwise, you're banned from society and kicked out. And who knows what else. So, and derided and admonished by your peers. And police were enforcing that. So I'm going to say, what's the difference? What's the difference between that and what I think is relatively tame in comparison, what you're seeing in Iran? And in France, that's just beyond the pale to discriminate on that level. If they want to wear a hijab, they should be able to wear it and it shouldn't make someone uncomfortable. Unless they have some sort of a hang up. And, you know, that's probably a result. If there is a hang up in the West, they're threatened by hijabs in Western countries. It's probably because of all the propaganda that they've been pummeled with since 9/11. So all these things are explainable when you sort of break them down rationally.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I was thinking that earlier when we were talking. It's just like we've got such a mishmash, so much cognitive dissonance in the waves of propaganda, you know, because in the post 9/11 era, you know, leading from like 9/11 to draw Muhammad, you know, there's just this constant, you know, fear push for Islam, you know, against Islamic people. So much so that people started, you know, in the wake of 9/11, people started attacking Sikhs because they're just ignorant and didn't know there was a difference between a Sikh and someone of the Islamic faith. So, yeah, it's just like we've got all these holdover psyops and then we've got all these new psyops, and they're kind of mutually exclusive in a number of departments. And then, you know, you throw in the mandatory masking, the ritual muzzle of shame, the health muzzle, the mandatory medical procedures. I mean, it's equally worse, probably worse in many Western countries when it comes to this sort of generally speaking.
Yeah. We have our own versions of it. So yeah, a lot of this, our viewpoints, I think, are informed. They're shaped by propaganda and manufacturing of consent. That's, you know, that I think that's pretty much given, considering what we've all seen kind of change in our own societies over the last 20 years, but especially in the last 3 years. I mean, if there's any lessons that we haven't learned yet after the last 2.5 years about what we're capable of, what the state's capable of, just think if COVID wasn't a virus, but was a religion, we're talking instead of COVID, we say COVIDianism, and then mandatory masks, and then compare that. And will a lot of people argue, Hesher, that it is a type of a religion, a cult. It's become a state-led cult. And is that worse? Is it less harmful than what you're arguing about in Iran? This is up for discussion.
Yes, it is. It absolutely is. I'm pretty sure I have referred to it as a cult before, and I'm going to stick to those guns. All right, Patrick, I hear the music. That means we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Anytime. Thanks. Pleasure to be on, Hesher.
All right. That's Patrick Henningsen, everybody. Check him out at 21stCenturyWire.com, AlternateCurrentRadio.com, and TNTRadio.live. That's where you can find both myself and Patrick. We're happy to be here with you folks today. I'm sorry to see the show ending. It feels like it went by fast. I could hang with you folks for another 3 hours, but I got to hand the mic. I got to pass the mic over here at TNT Radio. So stay tuned and have a great day. I'll see you tomorrow.